Number one, the shutdown is over. Number two, there may well be another one. And number three, they are expensive, those shutdowns are, and not just in dollars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, the 28th of January. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. From the newly reopened Bureau of Economic Analysis at the Commerce Department came this press release today. Bureau of Economic Analysis reports scheduled for this week and next will be delayed because of the effects of the partial government shutdown. It went on to list a couple of three of them, including its first pass at gross domestic product, which was supposed to come out on Wednesday. And then, this press release said, the BEA has not yet set new release dates for those economic reports. So, how's that economy doing that we haven't really been able to measure since before Christmas? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with what it takes to get all that economic data reporting machinery up and running again.
On December 21st, 2018, we got the final report on third quarter GDP from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The very next day, BEA and other agencies shut down. Today, government economists were trying to figure out how to get back up to speed. And it's an urgent matter. Gross domestic product is the total of all goods and services produced in the economy. Gary Hoover at the University of Oklahoma says it's important to business leaders and the Fed.
If I want to know how fast the economy is growing, I use these data as indicators of what I should expect going forward.
Pulling the GDP report together is complicated in normal times. Now it'll be even trickier. It includes data on manufacturing, trade, farming, construction, all from agencies that were also shut down. Erica Groshen ran the Bureau of Labor Statistics during the shorter 2013 government shutdown.
The federal statistical system is somewhat like a group of factories. Each program finely honed to produce the releases on time with the highest possible quality.
The fourth quarter GDP report will get done, says Mark Major at the Tax Policy Center.
The raw material that goes in there will have been collected or will be collected. And so I think that they'll be able to pull together those estimates at some point. And I think the key question that when you ask is, when is that point?
Today, BEA issued a statement saying that this week's scheduled economic releases will be delayed. No new release dates have yet been set. So, GDP on Wednesday morning? Nope. Eventually? Definitely. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And lest you think it's only data that's going to lag the actual economy as things get back going after the shutdown, let me disabuse you of that notion. Just like all those statisticians at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the private sector has been waiting on the government as well, and businesses are scrambling to get ahead of the inevitable bureaucratic and regulatory backlog. And with the not-out-of-the-question possibility of another shutdown in a couple of weeks, there is some urgency here. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one from Washington.
I first spoke with Justin Cox a couple of weeks ago at the height of the shutdown. He runs Atlas Brew Works here in D.C. The shutdown delayed labels he needed for his new beer. Now that the government is back open,
I don't know how long the backlog is or where we are within that queue.
He and other craft brewers are rushing to get approvals.
Who knows what's going to happen in 3 weeks, whether we'll have another shutdown again in these crazy times. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
There's also a line for small business loans. The Small Business Administration put those on hold during the shutdown, too. Tracy Ward is with Self-Help Ventures Fund in North Carolina.
One of the businesses that we're working with is a childcare facility in Western North Carolina. They serve low-income children in that area.
Their loan was on hold during the shutdown. Now they have to hustle.
They're in the position of purchasing the building that they've been leasing, and they need that purchase to happen by a certain date or they might lose the building.
Small businesses aren't the only ones who've learned a hard lesson from the shutdown. The Securities and Exchange Commission was also affected, and several big companies had to hold off on their initial public offerings.
So far in January, we've had no IPOs this year, whereas last year we had 17 IPOs at the same point.
Kathleen Smith is with Renaissance Capital.
It's a wake-up call to companies that are planning to go public because there's a risk that maybe the regulator won't be ready when they're ready.
Even with the furloughs at the SEC now over, there's no guarantee how long they'll be open for business. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A quick turn to geopolitics before we go on. Today, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on Venezuela's state-run oil company, PDVSA, it's known as. The White House is going to block about $7 billion of the company's assets, also cost the country about $11 billion in lost exports over the next year or so, trying to put some economic pain into Nicolas Maduro's hold on power in that country. Crude oil on global markets down about 3% today. Wall Street and the major indices also down, not quite as much, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I honestly didn't know this until this morning, but there is officially such a thing as tax filing season. It starts today. The Internal Revenue Service will accept and process your return now, not one day earlier for some reason. This is, as you know, the first filing season under the 2017 tax law, the biggest change to the Internal Revenue Code in 30 years. And that new tax law and the changes it has wrought could make a big difference in the size of your refund this year. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra did some asking around to see how people are feeling about that.
Graham Austin and her husband usually get back around $2,000 at tax time.
I think it'll probably be bad news for us this year.
Austin is a professor at Montana State University. Last week, she got this email from her HR department. It was a sort of warning, and it said,
stuff happened with the tax code last year. You might be in for an unpleasant surprise.
Most people got a tax cut under the new law. So last year, the IRS told employers to withhold less in taxes from their workers' paychecks. Matt Metris, a tax preparer in New York, says the thing is,
it's not really a one-size-fits-all kind of adjustment, and it doesn't really take into consideration the individual facts and circumstances that people face.
Like whether they rely on deductions that went away under the new law.
So some people might be getting refunds of size that they're normally used to, where some people may be getting them substantially lower or even end up owing.
That message hasn't gotten to everyone. Anthony Lower is an IT director at Temple University in Philly.
I had no awareness of that. Yeah, I wish I had.
He usually gets back a couple $1,000 every tax season. And he says his financial situation hasn't changed this year. But he just did his taxes online. He owes $1,300, which means
maybe no vacation this year.
His only hope for that vacation? He's going to ask an accountant for a second opinion. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
We'd love to hear your refund story. Are you expecting one? And if so, what are you going to do with it? You can tell us at marketplace.org. A couple of years ago, I did a panel thing at a big Vanity Fair conference out in Hollywood, movies in this changing age of content or something. And one of the people on the panel was Patty Jenkins, a name that will sound familiar to you if you saw Wonder Woman. This was a couple of months after the movie came out, and we got to talking about the Hollywood pitch meeting and how Patty Jenkins decides what movies to do.
Honestly, I feel the same way about making a movie as I feel about dating. Like, I don't have any desire to sell or be or force.
Which is to say, Patty Jenkins is not a person to go into a project half interested. Her latest project is a good example. It's a mini series that starts tonight on TNT. It's called I Am the Night, loosely based on the memoir of the late Fauna Hodel, whose father George came to be a suspect in the infamous Black Dahlia murder out here in Los Angeles. Patty Jenkins, it is good to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
You have done TV in the past, but this series, if I'm right, is the first one that you've done like soup to nuts. You EP'd it, you created it, you did the whole thing, minus the writing, I guess, which your husband did, right?
Yes, that's right.
What is it about this story that grabbed you? And I'll break the fourth wall here. When you and I were out at that Vanity Fair thing a year and a half, 2 years ago, we talked about this project, and you were passionate about it back then.
Did we talk about
it then?
Yeah,
we did. In the green room, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You know what's interesting about it? Right when I met Fauna Hodel and she told me her story,
right,
you know, my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it. And it was like her journey to becoming the person that she became that was the part that hooked me. I literally had a million reasons not to do this project over the years, but the story was so incredible that it never left me. And so years and years later, when the door opened up to make it, and my husband found this great way to break it, Sam Sheridan, yeah, and tell the story, you know, we just jumped at the chance.
I want to ask you about that years and years thing, because you are clearly an extraordinarily patient woman. You waited years to do this. You waited like 14 years between Monster and Wonder Woman. You see value in biding your time.
No, I don't. I've always been trying. I never stopped trying, with the exception about 2 years when I had my son, where I said, okay, let me just do TV. But I have never stopped trying full throttle to do the things I want to do.
Do you think your days of trying and not getting to do what you want to do are done now?
For now. For the moment. Yeah. Life is cyclical, and I definitely see that there are ebbs and flows of when people are interested and want to make your material. I definitely know many of the greatest directors of my lifetime who struggled to get their projects made later. Mm. You know, I don't take it for granted, but hopefully I can get some great stuff made, and or at least try for it now.
Do you see parallels between the opportunities that exist, writ large, I guess, in movies now and with television, as much content opportunity as there is out there?
I do. I actually think we're in a pretty great moment, as Wild West as it is.
Yeah.
Because I think there was a long period of time that there were some pretty strict conditions on what was a story worth telling, how and where, you know? When I first started working, it got a little rigid because the bottom fell out of indie films and only big tentpoles were being made in the theater, and television was still pretty controlled. It was network or it was HBO, and that was it, you know?
Yeah.
So I think finally this is this incredible time where a project like this, and this is a perfect example, it just can't be told in 2 hours, but it also can't run for years. So finally the moment has come, like, wow, look at this amazing way that people can both watch and then later stream and take it in however they want, this more complicated story.
I want to take a little sideways step here and ask you about your risk tolerance and about something I read about you, a quote you had about a project you didn't take on. And frankly, I forget what it was. But the gist of your quote was, look, if I had taken this on and it had flopped, the reaction would have been different because I'm a woman versus me being a man. And I don't want to make too much of the, you know, Patty Jenkins, highest grossing female director, Wonder Woman, blah, blah, blah thing. But there is a truth in there about Hollywood that I think you can speak to.
Yeah, there were some big blockbusters that I almost did along the road that I got the clear message that they were, that nobody thought they were going to do very well. And I said, this is a major step back for me to do, because if I do it, it's going to become, listen, everything I do, for better or for worse, is female director, female director, female director.
Yeah.
And so it's going to carry that shade with it. Of, you know, wow, rolled the dice and on this, and this female director did it and it didn't work, when everybody knew that it wasn't going to work in the first place. So that changes my attitude. Doesn't mean that I go into films being confident that they're certainly going to succeed. Wonder Woman was probably the riskiest movie that I could have taken on, but I believed in
it,
and I believed that I had a shot. And so that's all you can do.
It's so interesting that Wonder Woman, and it makes sense, right, in retrospect, that it was risky, but you look at the way it came out and you're like, holy cow, man, what a film. I mean, we talked about this at the Vanity Fair thing. I cried in that movie where she's walking across the World War I battlefield. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. I love that. That just means so much to me. I cannot tell you. That blows me away every time. To have that engagement with people is mind-blowing.
Patty Jenkins, new thing on TNT tonight. It's the Fauna Hodel story. It's a whole long Los Angeles thing. It's kind of amazing. It's called I Am the Night. Patty, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Great to talk to you, Kai, always.
We've got more of my conversation with Patty Jenkins. We talked about what it's like being an executive producer and having other directors work for you. Also, oh, by the way, a little movie she's working on called Wonder Woman 2. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
So the net shortfall when it's all over and done with is we think we'll be down about $3 billion of GDP.
No, $3 billion ain't a whole lot in the grand scheme of things, but that shutdown did have some costs. First, though, let's do the numbers. It was a down kind of day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials off 208 points, 0.8%, 24,528. The NASDAQ down 79, 1.1%, 7,085. The S&P 500 dipped 20 points, 0.7%, ended things at 26.43. This is going to be a super busy week for corporate earnings, by the way. Tech earnings will dominate. We'll hear from Apple, Microsoft, Amazon on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Investors are going to be listening real closely to see what Apple in particular has to say about China. Shares of NVIDIA plunged 13.8% after the computer chip maker cut its guidance for the fourth quarter. NVIDIA cited, wait for it, deteriorating macroeconomic conditions, particularly in China. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As Mitchell was saying, it's going to take a little bit before government agencies can catch up with their economic data reporting. But one agency that did release a couple of reports today, the Congressional Budget Office. The CBO is out with its 10-year economic forecast, also its best estimates of how much the shutdown cost. Keith Hall is the director of the CBO. Mr. Hall, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
So you have quantified this shutdown for us. What are the headline numbers?
Well, let me build up to it just a little bit.
We
think the effect on fourth quarter GDP of 2018 was about $3
billion. Yeah.
The first quarter of this year was about $11 billion.
Okay.
And that $11 billion is a little bit smaller because 2 months of the quarter we have recovery.
Right. Right. Well, let me get you to the recovery then, sir. How much of that are we going to get back, right? Because people are going to have to go out and make up some of that spending, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. Federal workers get paid. Federal government gets back to spending their appropriations. We think they'll spend it all. So we think it'll take about 3 months to get as much recovery as we're going to get. So the net shortfall when it's all over and done with is we think we'll be down about $3 billion of GDP.
It's entirely possible, Mr. Hall, that we're going to be back here again on the 15th of February. Without trying to pin you down one way or the other on what you think is going to happen, how bad would it be if we go through this all over again?
Well, for the most part, it just starts again. But there is an impact that's a bit bigger if the shutdown is longer than something like 5 weeks. You know, at some point, the lack of federal permits and certifications can start affecting the economy. And then, of course, the morale aspect of federal hiring, that can impact that over time.
Well, to that morale point, if I'm a federal worker now and I've got 3 weeks of paychecks coming in, did y'all model what federal workers may or may not decide to spend their money on in this 3 weeks that they've got money?
Not so much. I think the thing, the one thing that's notable perhaps is because they're getting a large paycheck, their withholding tax is likely to be a little too high.
Huh. So that is the back pay, right? They're going to get a chunk taken out of that.
That's right. Because we have a progressive tax rate, they're probably likely to get a little over withholding.
That's painful.
But we think they'll get back to it. About 3 months for it all to sort of get back as much as it's going to.
With a nod to the fact that the Congressional Budget Office is nonpartisan and has been through its existence, this is kind of a subjective question, but I'm going to see what you say. And it goes like this. Is this any way to run a railroad?
Well, I do know. I can say this. When we hire people here, one of our selling points, of course, is that we work so closely with Congress. If you want to support public policy and better government, we're a good place to work. But we're also a pretty safe place to work, the government in general. And so if that's impacted, then it gets harder to hire people. Mm-hmm. That gets to be a problem.
Alongside this report on the shutdown, sir, you released your economic projections for the next 10 years. It's a regularly scheduled report that y'all do. And I want to talk to you about economic growth. You say that growth is going to slow in the next year or so. Why?
Well, a lot of what's happening now with the relatively strong growth is basic stimulus from the tax bill. Mm-hmm. And at some point that stimulus is going to wane. In a sense, we're going to pay for this above trend growth with below trend growth for a little while, we think. And of course, under current law right now, the spending caps go back into play. So we see a kind of a drop in federal spending in a couple of years. And also under current law, the income tax rate decline from the law is going to go away. Income taxes will go back up in 2025 if you think that's going to happen.
Right. So that is the sequester, right, which people probably haven't heard of in 5 or 6 years. That's what's still on the books. And also those tax cuts are due to expire in 2025.
That's right. And that's one of the differences in what we do. We're estimating things under current law, not under current policy.
Yep.
So there's always a risk that policy will continue.
There always is. Keith Hall, he is the director of the Congressional Budget Office. Mr. Hall, thanks for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Speaking of back pay, as Mr. Hall and I were a couple of minutes ago, coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the logistics behind getting all of those furloughed federal workers paid, maybe by the end of the week. This is going to sound like I'm making a joke, but it's really not all that funny. Caterpillar is today's global economy four-letter word. The heavy equipment maker posted disappointing profits this morning. Any guesses why? Come on, anybody? China, of course, and the slowdown there. But Caterpillar is not the only company that has been hit by the softening in China. Apple cut its quarterly revenue expectations last month because of poor iPhone sales there. So we sent our China correspondent, Jennifer Pak, to talk to some Apple customers. She sent this report from Shanghai.
When the iPhone first came out, it wasn't officially available in China. So the only place to get an iPhone was at electronic markets like this one.
Some of the vendors here got a hold of iPhones from the U.S. and Hong Kong and sold them on.
In 2007, the price of the first iPhone was about $600, which was higher than the average monthly salary back then.
Apple reseller Mr. Ma, he doesn't want to disclose his full name because he's been selling iPhones on the gray market since the device's first launch. He says Apple prices have only gotten higher since, with the hype to match. Local news reports say in 2011, a teenager wanted an iPhone and iPad so bad he sold his kidney to pay for them. China says that by 2015, one out of every six people with a cell phone in the country was using an iPhone. Tech commentator and social media influencer Wang Guanxiong was one of them.
I still have about 20 Apple products. I use five of those on a daily basis.
But after he dropped $1,800 on the latest iPhone XS Max, he says it might be the last iPhone he buys.
The experience on the iPhone didn't exceed my expectations, and the price is much higher than Chinese brands, like Huawei's Mate 20 model, which has better features for Chinese users.
He's also frustrated with Apple's customer care service. Apple CEO Tim Cook has said the firm respects China, but Wang Guanxiong says he hasn't felt it.
Many iPhones were not launched in China first. They were sold in the US or Hong Kong. Now the phones are released at the same time in China. But what about localizing some features? They don't have many. Apple seems to respect our money, but does it respect our culture or our use habits?
No.
Apple isn't the only firm having a hard time in China. Fewer people are buying cell phones overall, in part because users have invested in good smartphones and don't feel a need to upgrade as often. Add in more Chinese competitors, and over the last 2 years, Apple sales have fallen to fifth place behind the likes of Huawei and Xiaomi. But if you walk on the streets of Shanghai or Beijing, iPhones seem to be everywhere. Apple is still setting the trend in China, says writer Stephen Schwankert, who covered the arrival of the iPhone in the Chinese market and identifies as a lifelong Apple lover.
Apple must be doing something right because all the competitors seem to be producing almost the same product, but with a different name at a different price point.
Hey, 你好.
Back at the electronics market, Apple reseller Zhou Mei says she's been selling more secondhand iPhones, up to five a day, likely because the newer models are too pricey. Driver Mr. Wong, he doesn't want to use his full name for fear of government retaliation. He sees his iPhone as a status symbol.
Buying an iPhone is like buying a car. You have China-made cars and imported ones. People only care about the brand you get.
And for him, the iPhone is the Mercedes-Benz of cell phones. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just to let you know that it happened. Howard Schultz, the former chairman and CEO of Starbucks, said last night on 60 Minutes that he is thinking about running for president. It's going to be interesting to see what his political fate does to that company's fortunes, which is why I mention it. Also, really, two more things. Number one, Schultz is not the founder of Starbucks. I feel like people always get that wrong. Also, not the first former CEO of a big public company to run. Carly Fiorina, anybody? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 208 today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ down 79, 1.1%. S&P 500 dipped 20 points, 0.7%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.